Continuing our reflection series on how ideas about the soul affect personal and cultural well-being, a reminder that you can access recordings of prior installments on the UUCPA website if you like. And to very briefly recap the first three introductory talks, I described how, while the modern era has given humanity immense gifts, its dominant philosophy of materialism, which holds that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality, has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational, aspect from human life. And although suicidal despair and authoritarian domination may seem poles apart, I suggested that both arise mainly from the resultant spiritual wasteland, what world religions scholar Houston Smith terms an abnormal condition for the human spirit, and that archaic religious remedies now only aggravate these and related ills. Then, drawing on Plato, I offered a transrational template very different from that old-time religion, particularly Christian and Islamic doctrines of outside-in salvation, and summed it up in four major points that the rest of this reflection series will gradually unfold. Point one, human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling slash destiny. Plato also describes the soul's spirit companion, termed daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, in Greek, and genius in Latin, that guides the soul during its earthly excursion. Point two, the most beneficial thing a person can do for oneself and others is to identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible. Point three, people can do this fully with no reference to or reliance on God or any ultimate deity or reality. And point four, affirming a transcendent inborn purpose in each person is the soundest root remedy for modernism's abnormal and many times lethal condition of spiritual barrenness, whether manifest in implosive depressions and self-harm or explosive power ploys and violence, and is thus both personally and culturally transformative. About that power ploy aspect, it's getting a bit ahead of myself, but since our reading dealt with the abuse of power, I want to offer one passage by mythologist Michael Mead that illustrates how the lack of any inborn purpose manifests in this deadly compulsion. He writes, "When people fail to find and use their innate gifts and life-enhancing powers, those who have no idea how to handle power will rise to the top. It happens all the time as those who do not know their inner value or true purpose become hungry for power of any kind. At the same time, others who lack purpose and self-knowledge willingly give their power to those who can't help but misuse it. When power is in the wrong hands, all kinds of exploitation results, and even the basic elements and rhythms of life become endangered." I'll return to this topic in more depth down the line. Lastly, I'll repeat that affirming a transcendent dimension of existence in no way devalues the astounding truths revealed by modernism and its science. It just means placing the modern rational and materialist mindset within a broader transrational sphere of awareness. For as Houston Smith also writes, "We have dropped transcendence not because we have discovered something that proves it non-existent. We have merely lowered our gaze." Today I'll describe the historical emergence of materialism's limited worldview, and next week begin to explore some of its harmful psycho-spiritual and societal consequences, which again I'll say much more about in later talks. As with my introductory reflections, I'll start with two relevant quotes. The first comes from cultural historian and philosopher Richard Tarnas, who we'll hear more from today. He says, ours is an age between worldviews, creative yet disoriented, a transitional era when the old cultural vision no longer holds and the new has not yet constellated. And renowned broadcast journalist Edward R. Murrow echoed this disorientation when he stated that anyone who isn't confused doesn't really understand the situation. I love that. So a man named Paul tells this brief personal story, which I have much abridged and very slightly adapted. I went outside to meditate under a large oak tree near our home in the countryside. A few minutes into the meditation, my awareness suddenly shifted, and I found myself hovering above my body. It was initially shocking, but although a completely new experience for me, it at the same time felt familiar. While looking down upon my body, I found myself in an expansive sea of peace, silence, and tranquility. After a few minutes, I was back in my body. I sat there in awe. I had never heard of such a phenomenon. I had not known we could experience consciousness without boundaries. I also wanted to understand how it was that I was both the Paul I had always experienced myself to be, and yet also a much bigger me to whom the expansive and peaceful experience was all so familiar. Who was the real me? Or were both me? The philosophy of materialism would tend to chalk up such experiences to an illusion slash hallucination caused by unusual brain functioning, or might suspect he dozed off and dreamt it, or at worst, that it heralded a mental health issue. But a soul-focused outlook simply answers Paul's "who was the real me" query, both. The ego self, typically considered me, and the much bigger, yet somehow familiar soul. This powerful experience sparked Paul's desire to discover more about such states and their effects on human health and potential through science. Years later, this Paul, now Dr. Paul J. Mills, who among other titles at UC San Diego, was professor of family medicine and public health, and director of the Center of Excellence for Research and Training in Integrative Health, had another compelling transrational experience that prompted further exploration. Though keenly aware that, quote, the vast majority of the scientific endeavor is highly materialistic, with metaphysical and mystical considerations outright rejected as non-existent, he did know of some fellow biomedical scientists who were not totally locked into the closed perspective of scientism, which one Wikipedia entry defines as the belief that science and the scientific method are the best or only way to render truth about the world and reality. Curious to learn more about their potential transrational experiences and insights and how those might bear upon their work, Mills went about interviewing them. And while he felt grateful to these scientists who shared important and often intimate parts of their lives with him, in the process, he also sometimes felt a sense of regret because he, quote, learned about the depth of their spiritual experiences and their journeys, and all the while knowing them over the years, we had never spoken of these things. Regrettably, this relational impoverishment also reaches into a whole, or actually unwhole, other stratum. Because in the book that emerged from his interviews, titled Science, Being, and Becoming, The Spiritual Lives of Scientists, Mills reports that some scientists he approached declined to speak publicly concerning their sharing, concerned that sharing their experiences might endanger their scholarly reputation and standing. One of them may have been sociologist Kyriakos C. Markidis, who while earning his doctorate had, like many others, quote, accepted the notion that the only legitimate form of knowledge is that of empirical science. But his perspective, and perhaps the security of his academic position, had evolved. And in Mills's book, Markidis highlights the reluctance Mills encountered by observing that there are, quote, a noticeable number of scientists and fellow academics who seem to live a double life. They keep their extraordinary experiences secret out of fear of being misunderstood and thus having their professional careers undermined. That this occurs out of fear reveals another hidden cost of unbending scientism, including on some scientists. Constricting self-censorship and the inevitable unease that comes with maintaining a double life. So on several levels, the same abnormal cultural condition that caused Professor Jacob Needleman's students to feel ashamed for wanting to explore those questions of the heart I mentioned in my first talk, who am I? Why are we here? What are we meant to serve? Which he also calls the questions that come with the search for the soul, has diminished many other lives long into adulthood. The next step in more fully understanding this debilitating condition is to examine when and how it arose. As this isn't our main focus, it's deliberately brief and omits much detail. But a streamlined summary over the rest of today and into next week will still prove helpful in seeing our present situation more clearly. So about that overview of how materialism rose. In Europe's Middle Ages, roughly the 5th through late 15th centuries, social, much less upward, mobility as we know it today largely didn't exist. With rare exceptions, people simply were their inherited social role of peasant, artisan, etc., and lifelong members of its corresponding social class. Of course, in many ways, this was severely limiting. Yet, since tradition prescribed compensation for different occupations, one social position commonly contained a measure of financial security. Plus, as most people rarely ever left, if ever, left their local area, community bonds were generally strong. And as German-American sociologist, psychologist, and philosopher Eric Fromm points out, there was a psychological upside. Because though socially and economically constrained, quote, in having a distinct, unchangeable, and unquestionable place in the social order, people were rooted in a structuralized whole, and thus life had a meaning which left no place and no need for doubt. This comforting certitude was undergirded by religious and cosmological understandings. For though the Catholic Church's threat of hell for the unrepentant was ever present, Fromm notes that generally the relationship to God was more one of confidence and love rather than doubt and fear. Part of that confidence stemmed from conceiving Earth as the center of a simple bounded universe around which all else revolved, and the theological parallel that we earthlings were the center of God's attention. Hence, while frequent political and religious disputes and violence meant people were often not tangibly secure, fundamentally most felt spiritually secure. And living in a familiar place with long-standing relational ties, rarely did individuals feel alone and cut off from others. So both inwardly and outwardly, people largely felt at home in the world. Then, suddenly, writes mythologist Joseph Campbell, the spell of the past, the bondage of tradition was shattered with sure and mighty strokes. The dream web of myth fell away, and the modern human emerged from ancient ignorance, like the sun at dawn from the womb of Mother Night. Obviously, this shattering coming out party, this metamorphosis that Campbell announces, didn't occur overnight. But in historical scale, it wasn't a whole lot longer, as the source of our first opening quote, Richard Tarnas, makes plain in this abridged passage. The modern self began to emerge with astonishing force and speed just over 500 years ago. Within the time span of a single generation surrounding the year 1500, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Raphael created their many masterworks of the High Renaissance. Columbus sailed west and reached America. Vasco da Gama sailed east and reached India. and the Magellan Expedition circumnavigated the globe, opening the world forever to itself. Luther began the enormous convulsion of Europe and the Western psyche called the Reformation, and Copernicus conceived the heliocentric, that is, sun-centered theory, and began the even more momentous scientific revolution. From this instant, the human self, the known world, the cosmos, heaven and earth were all radically and irrevocably transformed. From this, it's clear that not only was the modern sun's dawning that Campbell poetically described blurringly swift, its brilliance was staggering. And the image could not be more fitting, for at the center of it all, figuratively and literally, was the sun. Because while earthly explorers learned of new and other lands, Nicholas Copernicus discovered a new universe, one in which, as Galileo's telescopic observations and Johannes Kepler's three laws of planetary motion later helped confirm, the Earth no longer held center stage. Comprehending this new universe and reality produced intense amazement and awe in those who first detected it. Naturally, owing to the enormous change in the facts, and because they realized that for the first time, human brain power was able to accurately explain an incredibly complex system that previously seemed beyond deciphering. I combined and rearranged two separate passages in which Tarnas underscores the profound effects this had on human consciousness and humankind's self-image. The Copernican Revolution was the primordial cataclysm of the modern age, a stupendous event in which destroyed an entire world and constituted a new one. It was specifically this claim to cosmological truth that made it the very paradigm of modern humanity's new power of self-definition. The heliocentric discovery thus became the source and impetus for a tremendously magnified confidence in human reason. That new power continued nonstop, including Newton building on Kepler's work to develop his law of universal gravitation and laws of motion. With their publication in 1687, says Tarnas, the full foundation had been laid for the modern world and the sovereign confidence of the modern mind. And since modernism's ascension, he continues, there has not been any aspect of our existence subsequently untouched by its unique character and potency. While the astounding incandescence of this rise was indeed emancipating, exiting Campbell's womb of Mother Night wasn't a free one-way ride. Rather, as Tarnas points out, humanity was simultaneously liberated from and thrust out of the ancient medieval cosmic womb. Recalling that we started today with warped power dynamics, scientists living double lives, and young people ashamed to ask deep soul-searching questions, next week I'll conclude this overview with an opening look at the costs of this cosmological and philosophical expulsion. Namaste and blessed be.